The text that I'd like to start with this morning comes from Mark chapter 8, where we have recorded an event in the life of the Lord. And some words through which he exhorted his disciples. This is in Mark chapter 8, beginning in the 27th verse. And Jesus went out and his disciples into the towns of Caesarea Philippi. And by the way, he asked his disciples, saying unto them, Whom do men say that I am? And they answered, John the Baptist, but some say Elias, and others, one of the prophets. And he saith unto them, But whom say ye that I am? And Peter answereth and saith unto him, Thou art the Christ. And he charged them that they should tell no man of him. And he began to teach them that the Son of Man must suffer many things, and be rejected of the elders, and of the chief priests, and scribes, and be killed, and after 3 days rise again. And he spake that saying openly. And Peter took him and began to rebuke him. But when he had turned about and looked on his disciples, he rebuked Peter, saying, Get thee behind me, Satan, for thou savorest not the things that be of God, but the things that be of men. And when he had called the people unto him, with his disciples also, he said unto them, Whosoever will come after me, let him deny himself, and take up his cross, and follow me. For whosoever will save his life shall lose it, but whosoever shall lose his life for my sake and the gospel's, the same shall save it. For what shall it profit a man if he shall gain the whole world and lose his own soul? Or what shall a man give in exchange for his soul? Whosoever therefore shall be ashamed of me and of my words in this adulterous and sinful generation, of him also shall the Son of Man be ashamed when he cometh in the glory of his Father with the holy angels. In the midst of this exhortation to those that set out to follow him, those that listen to his words, Jesus said, Whosoever shall save his life shall lose it, but whosoever shall lose his life for my sake and the gospel's, the same shall save it. For what shall it profit a man if he shall gain the whole world and lose his own soul? What I desire to speak to you about this morning is about profit. About profit. But I'm not talking about the church's finances, bank account. I'm not talking about a business venture, but I'm talking about the type of profit of which Jesus speaks up here. As he contrasts to his disciples the gaining of a man's life in following Christ, or the giving over of that life to worldly things. He sets the value of those things in contrast to each other and asks those hearing him to consider the value of what's being set before them. In another place, as many gathered around and crowded around Jesus, thinking in their minds perhaps that they intended to follow him and to hear his words, he exhorted those that heard him to count the cost of discipleship, to consider for them what it would cost them to follow him. So I want to talk about profit. Now we I think, understand something about the idea of profit. This takes an analogy from business, from a business undertaking. I can relate to this. I think of my parents who run a restaurant. And they have to think about when they undertake something, whatever venture they're going to undertake, they have to think about whether or not there is profit in what they're doing. And by that, I mean they have to consider whether it is worth going down that path. So let's say, for example, that they were going to sell in their restaurant a steak dinner. Well, they're going to do a calculation. They're going to do some math. They're going to think about, well, if I'm going to sell this steak dinner to a customer, then it's going to cost me something to purchase the meat that will be made into that steak. And then I'm going to have to pay the chef to prepare that meal. And then I'm going to have to pay the waiter to bring the meal to their table. And then I'm going to have to pay the electric company to keep the lights on and keep the heat going so that the customer will be warm and comfortable and be able to see when they're in there sitting at the table eating. And for them to decide whether or not it's worth what they're doing, then the gain that they get from that sale of that steak dinner would have to outweigh the cost that would go into it. Well, Jesus here uses this analogy of profit, he uses this concept to call those that hear him to consider something more profound and more important than business, to consider what is the worth of their own soul in comparison of gaining the whole world. Jesus calls those that hear him to ask, what shall it profit a man if he shall gain the whole world and lose his own soul? What does it cost to be a disciple of Jesus Christ? What does it cost to follow him? Jesus asks those that hear him to consider it, to count it up. He uses an analogy in another place. He says, if a man set out to build a tower, he would count up the cost of the whole tower so that when he began to build, he didn't have to stop halfway in the middle and with half a tower because he'd run out of the resources to complete it. So when he sets out on this course, he must count up the cost, lest that partway through the process, he has to stop and people walk by and they look and they see half a tower and they laugh and they mock at this one who did not have what it took to complete, to finish the path on which he set out. And he likens that to discipleship of him. And he exhorts his disciples that in following him, they must be willing to forsake everything in order to be his disciples. This radical call that Jesus makes is, I think, difficult to understand. He uses language that is hard to understand, saying that that someone who loves father or mother or brother or sister more than him is not worthy to be his disciple. What does it cost to follow Jesus? I think about someone looking from the outside at discipleship, at being a Christian, looking at Christ and thinking what it would cost to go down that road to follow him. And perhaps they begin to think of all the things that they would need to give up, all the things that it would be necessary to leave behind to follow Christ. The cost, they think, I'd have to give up getting drunk. I'd have to give up that life of drunkenness. I'd have to give up sex outside of marriage. I'd have to give up envying others who have things that I want. I'd have to give up all these things. And they might consider that part of the cost and take it no further. Well, indeed, to follow Christ, one must forsake sin, because there's no way to turn toward God without turning away from sin. But if we listen to what Jesus has spoken, if we listen to what we say, we see that rather than that being a great cost to our account, that is in fact one of the great benefits of following and serving Christ. For those things which we might think are a great cost to us to give up, are actually the very things that bring us into bondage. They're the things that enslave us. They're the things that spiritually impoverish us, separating us from riches that we cannot have as long as we live in the bondage of sin. Jesus said to those that followed him, to those that heard his word, he said, he talked about freedom, true freedom. He said famous words that often quoted. He said, "The truth shall set you free." But that wasn't all that he said. And that those words often quoted came in the context of Jesus saying, he said, if you hear my words and you do what I say, you do my commandments, then you shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free. And the people that heard him said, we're not in bondage. We're not servants. What do we need to be set free from? We're free people. We might say the same thing. Now in America, 2017, almost 2018, we live in a free country. We're free people. We have everything. Jesus says, whosoever commits sin is a servant of sin. Doesn't matter how free you think you are. It doesn't matter how self-determined you believe your life to be. If you are enslaved by sin, then you are not free. Not truly free. Not the type of freedom that Christ gives. He says, if the Son will make you free, then you will be free indeed. Truly free. That's true freedom. When we consider profit, what is profitable? We are considering whether or not the investment that we put in, the cost that it takes to us, is worth what is received. So think for a moment, consider for a moment about what things we might put our life into. You know, we have so much to give, right? We have our minds, we have our strength, we have the energy that we have a certain amount of time here in this life. We have a limited resources of what we can put ourselves into, what we can pursue, what we can drive at. What could we put our life into? We could pursue pleasure. No, eat, drink, be merry, for tomorrow we die. We could live our life living for that pleasure. You know, God has provided many good things to us, many great pleasures, many great blessings. Food that brings us pleasure, joy, wine to make glad the heart of man. These things are gifts from God, things he has given, and we can enjoy those pleasures. But what does it mean if we give our lives to the pursuit of pleasure for its own end? You know, a few hundred years ago, the founding fathers of this country penned into the Declaration of Independence the inalienable right of man to the pursuit of happiness. And I don't know exactly what they meant by those words back then, but sometimes I think that what we think that they mean today must have been something very different from what they had in mind back then. But whether or not that's the case, I want to consider for a moment that happiness ultimately is not something that is obtained by pursuing pleasure and happiness for its own sake. If nothing else, we will find, and this is a proven principle of life, there's even a fancy name for the principle. But we will find that human beings have a way of adapting to the amount of pleasure that they experience. You know, we can see this in little ways in our own life. Just think about something like, you know, like air conditioning. This is just a simple pleasure that we enjoy in life. And before people had air conditioning, before it existed, they found other ways to stay cool. But if the temperature fluctuated between 71 degrees and 81 degrees, people weren't running around, you know, complaining because they were sweating a little bit. But now that we have air conditioning, in the summer, when the temperature starts to rise and the humidity starts to rise above 75 and 80, all of a sudden we need to get back inside, put on the air conditioning, get that temperature right to 70 degrees because we've gotten used to it. We've gotten used to a certain level of comfort. We've gotten used to a certain level of satisfaction. The same thing happens with food. You know, we can go great amounts of time without eating any kind of fancy or non-bland, tasteful food, and we would adapt and we would get used to it. But then what would happen when we first introduce a new pleasure into our life? All right, now I have this new pleasure, and at first, it makes us happy. At first, that thing increases our happiness. But then over time, we get used to it. And now, it doesn't really make us happy anymore. The only thing that happens is if that's taken away, if that's removed, if I had to sleep on the ground for a night instead of on my soft, comfortable bed with the soft, silky sheets, then all of a sudden, I'm uncomfortable. See, we adapt to pleasure. It can make us happy for a little while, but it can't last. That's what I'm trying to get across. That its benefits are not lasting. That they only go for some time. Now, we might think that, well, perhaps pleasure is not a worthy pursuit of our life and our energy. But we might substitute other things. Maybe it's having a great reputation, fame, glory, wealth. All of these things could be pursued, but I'm reminded of the words of one, and this is recorded in Ecclesiastes, of one great king who lived so many years ago. And he described, after having experienced every worldly pleasure and joy that perhaps could be imagined, certainly that he could imagine, you know, he had access to all this wealth, he had access to power, people, servants that would do whatever he said. He could have anything. He could have 1,000 wives, many more 1,000 servants, many more 1,000 horses, bars of gold laying around everywhere he went, musicians to entertain him anytime he wanted. He had all of these things. And what do you think? When he came to the end of his life, you think he's looking at it and he's thinking, yes, yes, I did it. You know, everybody else falls short, but I found true happiness. No, he writes this, Ecclesiastes chapter 1. Verse 2, vanity of vanities, saith the preacher, vanity of vanities, all is vanity. What profit hath a man of all his labor which he taketh under the sun? One generation passeth away, and another generation cometh, but the earth abideth forever. The sun also ariseth, and the sun goeth down, and hasteth to his place where he arose. The wind goeth toward the south, and turneth about unto the north, it whirleth about continually, and the wind returneth again according to his circuits. All the rivers run into the sea, yet the sea is not full. Unto the place from whence the rivers come, thither they return again. All things are full of labor, man cannot utter it. The eye is not satisfied with seeing, nor the ear filled with hearing. We can attempt to satisfy our deepest desires with everything around us that the world has to offer. And he says, the eye, it will never be satisfied with seeing. It will never have seen enough. I love to travel and see different places. I love to see different natural phenomena, like the cenotes in Mexico, these great holes in the earth's crust that go down hundreds of feet. Amazing to see. Amazing to see the mountains up in New England, to go up on their peaks and look out and be able to see for miles. I love to see the works of men that they've created, that in time past, ancient structures or great works of art. But if this is all there is, my eyes are never going to have seen enough to satisfy my soul. If it didn't satisfy Solomon, it's not going to satisfy me. In chapter 2, he writes this, I said in my heart, go to now. I will prove thee with mirth, therefore enjoy pleasure. And behold, this also is vanity. I said of laughter, it is mad, and of mirth, what doeth it? I sought in my heart to give myself unto wine, yet acquainted my heart with wisdom, to lay hold on folly, till I might see what was that good for the sons of men, which they should do under the heaven all the days of their life. I made me great works, I builded me houses, I planted me vineyards, I made me gardens and orchards, and I planted trees in them of all kinds of fruits. I made me pools of water to water therewith the wood that bringeth forth trees. I got me servants and maidens, and I had servants born in my house. Also I had great possessions of great and small cattle above all that were in Jerusalem before me. I gathered me also silver and gold, and the peculiar treasures of kings and of the provinces. I got me men singers and women singers, and the delights of the sons of men as musical instruments, and that of all sorts. So I was great and increased more than all that were before me in Jerusalem. Also my wisdom remained with me. And whatsoever mine eyes desired, I kept not from them. I withheld not my heart from any joy, for my heart rejoiced in all my labor, and this was my portion of all my labor. Then I looked on all the works that my hands had wrought, and on the labor that I had labored to do, and behold, all was vanity and vexation of spirit, and there was no profit under the sun. Here, someone who had everything. And this wasn't some hated despot. This was the beloved, wise King Solomon. He had the respect of those that followed him. He was honored by men. He was given everything. And he looked back at all of it. And he said, there was no profit. No profit. Jesus asks, what does it profit a man if he gained the whole world and lose his own soul? Among other things, I think what we might see from this is the value that Jesus places on the soul of man. If indeed the soul of man itself is of more value than all the riches of the world, then it must be a precious thing. And why? And why is it a precious thing? It's a precious thing because it has an existence that extends beyond this life. Among other things, it we are called to consider is important because even if we were to have all the good things in this life and lose our souls, we profit nothing. We profit nothing. It says in Hebrews that it is appointed unto men once to die, but after that the judgment. And judgment stands before man as a reminder and as a testimony that man's soul continues after his body is lying in the grave.
Amen.
And his soul will appear before the judgment seat of God. And it says that God will render to every man according to his deeds, according to the things that were done while he was in this body, in this life, according to the words that he spoke, the works that he wrought with his hands. God will bring all these things into judgment. So Jesus can say, in another place, he uses the metaphor of something of great value, like our own hand or our own eye. And he says, if your eye causes you to sin, pluck it out. He says, it's better to enter into life without an eye than to go to hell with both eyes. If your hand causes you to sin, cut it off. Nothing is worth it, he says. Jesus is giving us a new framework to make calculations about value in this life. And in order to make the correct calculations, we have to see that life extends beyond when our body goes to the grave. We have to see that we are concerned not only with this world, but the world to come. Not only with this life, but the life to come. Not only with the body, not only with the flesh, but with the soul. It is appointed unto men once to die, he says, but after this, the judgment. In Romans 6, Romans 6:16, Paul writes, know ye not that to whom ye yield yourselves servants to obey, his servants ye are to whom ye obey, whether of sin unto death or of obedience unto righteousness. But God be thanked that ye were the servants of sin, but ye have obeyed from the heart that form of doctrine which was delivered you. The principle that Paul expresses here is that we will serve something. Bob Dylan wrote it in a song. You've got to serve somebody. It may be the devil, it may be the Lord, but you're going to have to serve somebody. You know, we like to think that we're our own master. We like to think that we're living our own life. But the reality is we are going to serve someone. We are going to serve something. We're going to devote our life to some cause, even if we're unintentional about it. Even if we're just floating along, living from day to day, seeking out the pleasures before us. Know it or not, we are serving something. And Paul writes that whoever you are serving, you are, by definition, the servant of that thing. So if you serve sin, you are a servant of sin. But if you serve obedience and righteousness, you are a servant of God. Jesus calls his disciple. He calls his disciples to count the cost. To count the cost. Solomon writes, what profit hath a man in all his labor which he taketh under the sun? And then he answers his own question in showing that in all of those things there was no profit. There was no gain. Jesus asks, what does it profit a man if he gain the whole world and lose his own soul? Showing the value, the eternal value of that. And Paul writes to Timothy. Paul writes to Timothy in 1 Timothy 4. about a different kind of prophet, a different kind of thing to seek value in. He says in 1 Timothy 4:7, "But refuse profane and old wives' fables, and exercise thyself rather unto godliness." Here Paul uses the metaphor of bodily exercise. The words here hearken to the training of the athletes, the training of the ancient Greek athletes. And he says, but he says, exercise thyself unto godliness. Godliness. He says, for bodily exercise profiteth little. Profiteth little. You know, I'm a big believer in the importance of bodily exercise. You have to use your body, and in order to maintain your energy, in order to have strength, to keep your muscles strong, to keep your body in good health. And when you go out and you make the investment of going out and walking or running or lifting weights, and you go and you do that, and maybe you spend a half hour doing that, I find that there's a benefit to it. I give up a half hour of my time, some discomfort, and what I gain is more energy, feel better. I get a little profit from that. But as valuable as that may be to my body, Paul writes here about something so much more valuable. He says, bodily exercise profiteth little, but godliness is profitable unto all things. Godliness is profitable. It's worthwhile. It's valuable unto all things. Why? Having promise of the life that now is, and of that which is to come. Two more scriptures in closing. I mentioned that Jesus talked about his disciples counting the cost. And he said in Luke chapter 14, verse 33, he said, "Whosoever he be of you that forsaketh not all that he hath, he cannot be my disciple." He called his disciples to a radical service of him, to give up everything for him, to let nothing stand in the way of following him, even if it was their own family, their own father or mother. It's a hard saying here, he says. "If any man come to me and hate not his father and mother and wife and children and brethren and sisters, yea." What? Jesus was known for hard sayings. He was known for saying things that offended people, that confused people sometimes. Well, I quoted it from the other another passage in Matthew, where he says, "Think not that I am come to send peace on earth. I came not to send peace, but a sword, for I am come to set a man at variance against his father, and the daughter against her mother, and the daughter-in-law against her mother-in-law, and a man's foes shall be they of his own household. He that loveth father or mother more than me is not worthy of me, and he that loveth son or daughter more than me is not worthy of me. And he that taketh not his cross and followeth after me is not worthy of me. He that findeth his life shall lose it, and he that loseth his life for my sake shall find it." Jesus says that we must love him and desire him more than anything, anybody in our life, and even, he says, our own life. Must be willing to give up everything for Christ, for the sake of Christ. Must be willing to forsake all for the sake of Christ. And so he calls his disciples to count the cost, considering that the value of our soul is of far more value than anything that we might give up in this life. Let me close with this. Jesus counted the cost to. In the passage we started with, Peter took him aside to rebuke him because of what Jesus said. Because he said the time was coming that he would be rejected. The time was coming that he would be delivered up by the elders, the chief priests. And he would suffer. And he would die. And on the third day, he would rise again. And Peter takes him aside and says, "No, no, no, you can't do this. You can't give up your life. This is everything. Your healing, your teaching. You've shined a light into our day, in our time, in our generation. People have hope again. You can't lay down your life. You can't die. We won't let you do it, Jesus. We won't let you." And Jesus rebukes him. He says, "You savor the things of men more than the things of God." This seems like a harsh rebuke for Peter, concerned about his friend, concerned about his Lord. But Peter couldn't see, he couldn't understand the cost that Jesus was willing to pay for the sake of the kingdom of God, for the sake of you. Jesus, he considered the cost and the value that he would receive, the profit that he might gain from laying down his life. Consider his calculation. In 2 Corinthians 8, Jesus made an offering that was offered by grace, undeserved. What we could give back to him compared to his precious life that he gave seems like nothing. But his great love and the Father's great love with which he loved, so loved the world, made him willing to give the most valuable, precious thing, his only begotten Son. And Jesus was willing to give it all up. To leave throne in heaven, all riches, and come down and be born. To be born to poor parents. Couldn't even get a place in the inn which to give birth to the child, had to be laid in a manger. Second Corinthians 8:9. "For ye know the grace of our Lord Jesus Christ, that though he was rich, yet for your sakes he became poor." That was his transaction. He gave up the riches and he became poor. And he submitted himself to death and to suffering. What did he hope to gain by that? What was the value in that? What was the profit in giving up his life and giving up everything? To save sinners like you and me. He says, "Though he was rich, yet for your sakes he became poor, that ye, through his poverty, might be rich."